And we're holding on page 70 in Sota, middle of Os Ein Zayin, about the middle of page. Continuing Darshaning the Psukim about the Meraglim. So where we said they came up from Negev and he came to Chevron, he being Kolev, specifically went to Chevron to Davin by the Maris Machbeva. Now the pasuk continues, Vashom Achimon Sheshai Vesalmai Yulidei Ha'anok. And there were these three people who were descendants of the giant. And that's why later on the Meraglim said that we're afraid because we saw giants over there. Mind you, Marshal says that actually that's part of their lie, is since the Gemara had said that only Kolev went to Chevron, then they didn't go to Chevron, so how would they have seen these guys? So they must have made the whole thing up. With that said, there are Midrashim that they actually did meet up with giants, and there is the possibility maybe they saw them. Eitz Yosef talks about maybe they saw them in the mountains around Chevron. They didn't go into Chevron proper, maybe, but they saw them in the mountains around Chevron. Besides which, also anyway, some of the Mefarshim learn, like we talked about yesterday, that when it says that only Kolev went to Chevron, means all of them physically went there, but only he went there, only he, while he was there, went to Davin by the Maris Machpelah. Okay, anyway, so why are they named, why do they have those names? So the Gemara is going to douse in their names. Achimon is so-called Miyumon Shebe'echa, because he was the strongest of his brothers, just like Miyumon, Meloshon Yamin, just like the right hand is stronger and more important, so the same way he was the strongest and the most important of his brothers. Sheshai was so-called Shemesim Asa'aretz Keshchisus, because it would make the earth a destruction when he walked on it, because he was so large and his footsteps were so heavy that they would dig into and destroy the earth. Rashi says, where does the word Sheshai, how does that come to relate to the word Shchisus? So Rashi says, because Sheshai can be related to the word Shesh, like an Amudei Shesh in Megillas Esther, meaning marble pillars. If you put a marble pillar on the ground, then it will sink in and leave a major mark over there. So therefore, so it would mean like that. This Gemara is also in Yuma, this whole discussion about the names of the giants. Rashi over there explains a different point as well, that Sheshai can be related to the word Hashes, as in you have in Megillas Eicha, Hashes v'Hashova, which means destruction. So therefore, also, in other words, it means that he destroyed the earth as he walked on it. And Talmai was so-called Shemesim Asa'art Tzlomim Tzlomim, because he would make furrows in the ground wherever he walked, same idea. In other words, his footsteps were so heavy that he would dig major gouges into the earth. Dovarach, another explanation. Now, the other explanation is not really contradicting the first one, so Rashi, in the Gemara and Yuma, takes out those words and says they don't really belong. It's not a different explanation, it's rather a different fact about them. But we'll talk about in a second another reason to keep that girsa. Anyway, the Gemara says, Achimon bona Anos. Achimon built a city called Anos. Sheshai bona Olush. Talmai bona Talbush. So each of them founded a major city of that time. And the pasuk says, Yulidei Ha'anok. They were all born to the giant. So why this word Anok for a giant? Shema, when you have other words in Tanakh for giants, Rephoim and Nephilim and so forth, Shema Nik and Chama B'Kemosan, they make the sun like a necklace for them because of their height. In other words, they're so tall that the sun shining from behind them looks like a necklace around their neck. The Maharal makes an interesting point over here. First of all, why is the Gemara dousing their names anyway? If so, what? I mean, we have lots of people named in Tanakh, and we don't always douse in their names. And what's the Dover Acher? So the Maharal explains like this. The Pasuk is saying that they came to Chevron, or he came to Chevron, whatever, and there were Achimon, Sheshai, and Talmai. The way the Pasuk phrases it, sounds like we should know who they are. So Mela, if it said first Yulidei Ha'anok, if it first described them as the children of the giant, then we would understand. Okay, well, they've found giants over there, and what are those giants' names? Here are their names. Since the way the Pasuk phrases it, making it sound like we should know who they are, then the answer is their very names tell us something about them. So as soon as you hear the name Achimon, you should realize this is a brother who was the strongest of all of them. As soon as you hear the name Sheshai, you should realize that this is a person who makes furrows and then holes and gouges in the ground as he walks and so forth. And then the Dover Acher, says the Maharal, is another way of looking at it. Why should you be expected to know these people even before you've been introduced to them? Because each one of them built a major city, and for that alone, he's famous. Okay. Next. So the Pasuk says, V'chevron sheva shanim nivnasa lifnei tsoyan mitzrayim. Chevron was built 7 years before Tsoyan in Egypt. Tsoyan, in Greek, it's called Tanis. It was a major city in Mitzrayim at various times in Egyptian history. It was the capital. So the Gemara says, my nivnasa. What does this word nivnasa mean? Literally, it means that Chevron was built 7 years before Tsoyan. Ilema nivna samamish, do you mean literally that it was built 7 years before? What's the logic? Extra odom bonum bias of no cotton, kodim shayivna bias of no godel? Does a person build a house for his younger son before his elder son? Dichtiv. And the fact is that Canaan is younger than Mitzrayim, as the Pasuk says, Vnei Chom, Kush u'Mitzrayim u'Fur Tochnan. Now, the Gemara is assuming, in other words, that Chom was involved in building up these various places that are going to become the lands of his respective descendants. So he would go to Mitzrayim and he'd help build a major city over there that his son Mitzrayim would have a kingdom that he'd rule from there, and then so forth with each of the other places. So Mitzrayim is actually the second son, Canaan is the fourth. So what would be the logic that a city in Canaan was built before a city in Mitzrayim? Now, you know, there are Mephoshim who say that's fine. That is exactly what it means. It really was built 7 years before. And in Bechlau, you have Mephoshim actually who say that maybe Canaan was even one of the older sons of Ham, and the reason why the Torah lists him last is because he was the most degraded out of all of them. Like this, you have in the story with Noach getting drunk. The pasuk says "V'chom hu avichnan," implying that Canaan was already around at the time, and so in that case, that would mean he had to be the eldest. Otherwise, when were the other ones born? They'd just come out of the table. So on a pshat level, on various pshat levels, you could understand that it means literally that Hebron was built before Mitzrayim. And in Seder Duris, for example, it mentions, I don't remember his source, that in fact, if you figure that Hebron, the earliest Hebron could have been built, the Pashtos, would have been at the time of the Dura Floga, because before that, everybody was living in the one place in Shinar rather than scattering all over the whole world. So therefore, now the Dura Floga, the Tower of Babel, took place in the year 1996 since creation, so Hebron would have been founded then. Soyan and the nation of Mitzrayim 7 years later, and therefore Seder Adoris makes a point that Mitzrayim was a great world power from then until Yitzias Mitzrayim, so 445 years from 2003 till 2448. But anyway, the Gemara over here doesn't want to assume that. So Ella Shahosim of Vunal Echem Meshiva B'Tzoyim. Rather, what it means is that Hebron was built up, meaning, in other words, Rashi said, not built up, but rather it was cultivated, it was fruitful, seven times as much as Tzoyim. So Sheva Shonim, in other words, would mean seven times the Nivnasa, it's fruitful even more than Tzoyim Mitzrayim. Now, let's consider, continues the Gemara, Ve'en Lecha Troshim Be'eretz Yisrael Yosim Echebron. Now, there's no place in Eretz Yisrael that's more rocky soil that doesn't really produce crops more so than Hebron. Mishum dekabri b'shichvi, we see it's such inferior soil that they use that for grave sites. On the other hand, there's no better land, there's no more fertile land than Mitzrayim. We see when the Torah wants to compare the fertility of Sdoim and other cities before they were overturned, it compares it to the garden of Hashem, to the land of Mitzrayim. And within Mitzrayim itself, there's no better and more fertile place than Tzoyan. Dichtiv, ki hoyu b'tzoyan sarav, as the Pasuk describes, that his ministers were in, Tzoyan. So to actually explain, the context of the Pasuk is the kings of Yisrael and Yehuda sending ambassadors to Mitzrayim to ask for their help, and the Navi telling them it's useless, Mitzrayim is never helps anyhow, but so we see, in other words, so Sarav can refer to the Jewish Sarim, it can refer to the Egyptian Sarim, whatever the case, we see that Tzoyan is the capital of Mitzrayim, and being the capital, it would naturally be the most fertile area. And nevertheless, even though Hebron is the worst of Eretz Yisrael and Tzoyan is the best in Mitzrayim, nevertheless Hebron mevuna echem mishiva b'Tzoyan. Nevertheless, Hebron is built is fruitful seven times as much as Tzoyan. So that's the point the Pasuk wants to make over here, is that you should realize how good even the worst parts of Eretz Yisrael are. And you also have, by the way, Marsha points out, we mentioned about the giants as well. Part of the point was that's why the Pasuk is highlighting the point that the Kalev was not afraid to go there, even though he knows there were these powerful giants over there, because he trusted in Hashem. Rashi, the Gemara mentions this point at the end of Ksuvus as well. There's also Rashi on the Psukim that mentions another point as well, that from a Medrash, that the idea is like a person will first build the nicer building, and then the leftovers are the building materials he'll use for the lesser one. So therefore, we can literally take it in the sense that Hebron was built before Tzoyan, in the sense, in other words, like first was built the better thing, Hebron, and then he used like the leftover materials to build Tzoyan. Ion Yaakov, by the way, mentions, okay, so even if we're going to say, like our Gemara over here, the Chevron is much more, seven times as fertile as Soyan, then you're back to the question. Canaan occupies Chevron. Mitzrayim occupies Soyan. Still, why would the younger son get a place so much better than his older brother? Somebody in Yaakov says that's not a big deal, you know, the same way as Yaakov favored his next youngest son, Yosef, the same way Canaan, the same way Chum can favor his youngest son, Canaan, and give him the nicest place. Okay. Marshall, by the way, mentions a point that we find that David's capital was in Hebron for 7 years. If it's such a bad place, why of all places did he have his capital there? So, as Marshall says, because at that point he ruled over only over Shevet Yehuda, so they wouldn't allow him to live in a nicer place. with that said, the Zohar actually makes a point. The Zohar brings that David had to be king for there in Hebron for 7 years because he had to connect with the others because he's the fourth level, he's the fourth leg of the Merkava, and therefore he needed to be there for a period of time. So, yeah. Okay. The Gemara asks, Hebron Troshim Havoi. So you're telling me that Hebron is rocky soil? V'haksiv, the Pasuk says, when Avshalom is getting ready to start his revolt against David, the Pasuk says, Vayhimi Ketza Boim Shana, at the end of 40 years, and when we learned about this in Nozir a couple of months back, the Gemara explained it meant 40 years since back in the time when the Jewish people had first asked for a king in Shmuel's times, before Hashem told Shmuel to appoint Shaul. So now it's 40 years since then. It's about 36 or 37 years into David's reign. By Yomer Avshalom al HaMelech, Avshalom says to the king, he needs an excuse to get out of Yerushalayim. He's going to go to Hebron and start his revolt over there, but he needs an excuse to go to leave. So he says, El Chana, let me please go. Avshalom is nidresh and adarti l'Hashem b'Hebron. And I will pay my vow that I vowed to Hashem in Hebron. You just see, described it. Now we learned in Nazir that Avshalom was a Nazir Olam, so he'd have to shave his hair and bring his korbanos of a Nazir once every 12 months. So now he's saying that he made a neder to do that, and he wants to go to Hebron to fulfill the neder. Now the Gemara explains elsewhere that it means that he actually went to Hebron to bring the korbanos, which is fine. This is before the Beis Hamikdash was built, and you could bring korbanos on bamos anywhere you want. But still, another point in it is the Omer of Ivya, Omer Rabba, Omer of Chana, and it would be Tamer, Rabba, Rabba, Chana, Shaholach Lahavi Kvasim Mechevron. His excuse was that he wanted to go and get sheep from Hebron. So in other words, not necessarily is he actually going to Hebron to bring the korban, even though the Gemara mentions elsewhere that that may well be what he was doing. But nevertheless, the Gemara is saying that actually his real reason to go there was to bring sheep from there. Because the best sheep come from there. Because Vitanya, we learn in Abraisa, later on the times of the Beis Mikdash as well, Elim Mimoyav, when they needed rams for the Korbanos, the best ones came from Moyav. We find various places in Tanakh that Moyav produced very good breeds of sheep, and the rams from there were the best ones. Kvasim Mechevron, as far as the younger sheep, those the best ones came from Chevron. So therefore, Avshalom's excuse is he wants to go to Hebron for that. The point being, if the best sheep come from Hebron, it must be a very fertile place. The answer is Fakert. Mina, that's exactly it. From that itself, there's your answer. Aidi to Klisha Ara, just the opposite, because the soil there is very thin. It's rocky, and you have only a thin layer of topsoil. Aidi to Klisha Ara, Avdaraya, therefore, so people don't plant crops over there because they're not going to grow well. Instead, it produces a lot of grass. Instead, they grow a lot of grass there because grass has very shallow roots. The Shaman Kinyana, so the livestock that grow there have plenty to graze on, and therefore they become good and fat and healthy. So it does actually work out very well with the point that Hebron is a very rocky and not so agriculturally good area, and nevertheless, as we're saying, it was still better than Soyan. Okay. Next, the Pasuk says, going back to the Meraglim, Vayashuvu Mitur Haaretz, the Pasuk says they return from their spying out the land. Now the Pasuk also says they went and they came. So Rashi takes out the it's not so much that the Gemara is pointing out a contradiction between two Pasukim. The question is, once it says Vayashuvu, why does it need to say Vayavoyu? Why does it need to say at this point Vayilchu Vayavoyu? They came, they went and they came. The Torah wants to compare their going, their leaving, to their coming back. Ma Bia Be'etzera. Now, when they came back, they already had a bad idea. They were planning to slander Eretz Yisrael. In fact, they proceeded to do Afalicha Be'etzera. The same way when they went, they already had this bad idea. To begin with, they were going with intention to slander Eretz Yisrael. Marsha points out, you know, we said that you have the Jerusha, we said before, Kulam Anoshim, that they were all important Choshev people, Tzadikim, Anoshim, Ba'oz Hashar, Kshedim, how you, but that means Ba'oz Hashar, when they were picked, they were Kshedim, but then soon after that, they started going bad. Why they went bad, so of course we have the explanation in Chassidus, which comes first from the Kutta Torah and is explained in any number of Sichas, in any number of Maimorim and Sichas from all the Rabbeim, and Parshas Shlach, that their mistake was that they wanted the kind of avoida they have in the Midbar. They're going to live off Mon, they're going to be learning Torah full time. They didn't want the kind of avoida involving plowing and planting and whatnot that they're going to do in Eretz Yisrael. There's a variety of other explanations that are given among them that they were afraid they're going to lose their high positions once they come into Eretz Yisrael. After all, like this Kolam Anoshim Rosh Ben Yisrael Hema, they were leading people among the Jewish people, so they're concerned when they come into Eretz Yisrael things are going to be different. They're going to lose their high position. There's an explanation along the lines of that they were afraid that maybe they were afraid maybe we don't have enough schusim to conquer Eretz Yisrael to be able to especially be derech nes, and a variety of other reasons that are given what made them go bad. We talked about yesterday a point that Eva makes. You know, the expression is the eitz of the meraglim, meaning that it started off with that they start injecting their own personal agenda into it, and then that's the beginning of things going bad. Okay. So that's why it says Vayelchu Vayavoyu. A couple of the Mephoshim over here deal with the point also that the Pasuk also wants to make the point, and the Pasuk also wants to stress the point like this. You know, it took them, Rashi mentions on the Pesukim, after all, it took them, Eretz Yisrael is 400 by 400 parasa, which means it would take them 40 days to go in one direction and then 40 in another direction plus the time getting back. And like this, in the end, they were only away for 40 days, and therefore the Jewish people ended up spending 40 years in the Midbar. How is that? And the answer is Hashem gave them Kfitzes HaDerech, because otherwise the Jewish people would be delayed in the Midbar longer. So the idea would be, in other words, that's why, because Vayochu Vayavoyu, because even when they were going was the Eitzarah, so really, by rights, the days they were going would also have to be counted towards the time in the Midbar, and therefore Hashem did the Jewish people a favor and made the Meraglim be able to go faster. The pasuk continues, Vayisapru loy vayomru, they told over to Moshe and to the Jewish people, and they said, Bonu ala eretz asher shlachtonu, we came to the land to which you sent us, v'gam zavas cholov advashi, now it is also a land that flows with milk and honey, v'zepiria, and this is its fruit, which as we learned before, they brought the fruit because they wanted to scare the Jewish people realizing how huge it is, but they continue, efes ki azam, however the people there are powerful, and so forth. So why are they beginning with praise of Eretz Yisrael and saying that Zavas Chol of Advash? Amar Rav Yechon, Meshumar Meir, Kol Dvar Loshen Hara, Shein Omrim Divrei Emes Betchilasei, because when a person speaks Loshen Hara and doesn't say some truth at the beginning, Ein Meskayim Besofei, it won't last, because people are going to realize the whole thing is baloney. So they have to first say something Emes, so that people will believe them, and therefore they have to begin with the fertility of Eretz, with the goodness of Eretz Yisrael, which everybody knows that's true. And then they could start with their lies on that. Now, Marsha deals with the question, where's the lie over here, though? They're saying that the land is Zavas Cholav Advash, which is true. They're saying that the people are strong and the cities are fortified. That's also true. In Parshas Ekev, Moshe tells the Jewish people, you're coming into a land where you should realize the people are very mighty and there are fortified cities. So Marsha explains like this. They were supposed to be, the Meraglim had two jobs. Number one, they have to look whether it's possible to conquer Eretz Yisrael, or more really, as we talked about yesterday, Moshe's intention was not whether it's possible. Of course, it's possible. Hashem sent them, but rather, where would be the weakest point, where would be a good place to invade. Then, second of all, they also have to see, does Eretz Yisrael have in it things that are needed for people to live off of? And that's also part of what Moshe tells them. He says, doesn't have the necessities of life. So now the Meraglim are coming back and saying what is it? So they start by saying something true. What did they do though? They also, part of their claim was that Eretz Yisrael does not have all the Shivas Aminim. Now out of the Shivas Aminim, we talked about before, they brought grapes, figs, a fig and a pomegranate. So they were claiming that Eretz Yisrael has those kinds of things, plus also Zavas Cholover Dvash, which is meaning in other words, that it has dates and honey flows from them. All very nice. But where's the wheat? Where's the barley? Where's the olives for olive oil? Those are all necessities. And they're implying that Eretz Yisrael does not have those things. But Zepiria, this that we brought back, is the sum total of the type of fruit that Eretz Yisrael had, and it does not have the other ones that are needed for Chaya Nefesh. So there's their lie. Then on top of that, they're saying that you can't, that they can't, then on top of that, they started saying that Eretz Yisrael that is powerful, which is true, but then they continued by saying that we saw the giants, which Rav Shaul is saying, like we said before, that part is not true, because they didn't see the giants, because the giants are in Chevron, and only Kolev saw them. That's according to Rav Shaul's shita that we said before, that only Kolev went to Chevron, and that the giants were only in Chevron. On that point, like I said before, Ion Yaakov points out that maybe they saw them in the mountains around Chevron, and besides which, maybe all of them did go to Chevron and just Kolev went there for the Maros Machpelah.
Rashi says over there that they heard them saying we see.
They heard them saying we see. Yeah, the Gemara is going to quote that later on, right? So according to Marashah's way of understanding, we would have to say that they made that part of the story up. But yeah, there are Madurot. Yeah, Rashi mentions that point that they said we see little human shaped ants. So, you have a Medrash tells a story where the daughter of one of the giants eats a pomegranate and then eats a pomegranate and throws away the rind of it, and one of the meraglim is inside the rind and almost gets taken out with the trash. So there is reason to say that they saw them or that they saw the giants, but Marashah seems to learn that no, they didn't actually see him. So that was their claim. So they're beginning with something true, and then they're continuing with falsehood. Benny Hoyada says a cute point on it. He says, you know, you look at the word sheker, the second and third letters of it, kuf and resh, spell out kar, like cold. You tell, a person tells a sheker, and there's no MS, the shin representing MS at the beginning, it's going to be kar. People are going to be cold and indifferent to it. So therefore, there has to be a little MS represented by the shin. In Basi Lagani also talks about that kuf and resh are letters associated with clippers, and shin is a letter of MS, and therefore it's placed together with it. Nitaka brings from the Zohar about this point of a sheker having MS at the beginning represented in the very structure of the word sheker. Next, the pasuk says, "Vayahas Kolev es Amel Moshe." So, Kolev quieted the people to Moshe. Now, the simple meaning of "Vayahas" means that he quieted them. He got them to quiet down, so that he could get them to listen to what Moshe says or what he has to say about Moshe or whatever Rashi mentions on the pasuk. The simple meaning of "Vayahas" is to tell people to be quiet. But the Gemara is understanding in a different way. Omar Rava or Rava Shehsisam Bidvarim. He misled them with words. So in other words, the word Vayahas can also be taken Meloshin Hasasa. That he convinced them and misled them into being quiet by making it sound like he's going to speak El Moshe in a derogatory way about Moshe. Namely, what happened? Dechazia LeYeshua to Kamishtoi. Now he first saw that Yeshua wanted to speak. And that everybody shouted him down and said, Amile, they said to Yeshua, Dein resh ketia yamalo, should this one with the cut-off head speak? So they didn't want to hear from Yeshua. What do they mean by the cut-off head? Rashi explains that Yeshua did not have any sons. We find in the Gemara Megillah that Yeshua had only daughters. Now, the daughters themselves even were born much later. It says that he married Rochav, and he had daughters with her, and eventually great Nevi'im came out from them. But therefore, so they're saying, you don't have any sons. So therefore, your children aren't going to have a chelek in Eretz Yisrael anyhow, so you have no right to speak. They were clinging to Yeshua. That's how Rashi explains. Now, there is the point, of course, daughters do inherit an Eretz Yisrael, but again, first of all, Yeshua didn't necessarily have his daughters at that time, but anyway, the din about daughters inheriting was only with Nois Tzlafot many years later, so they didn't necessarily know about it at the time. Anyway, that's Rashi. Marsha says that's a bit of a doichek. The fact is, Yeshua at this time was only 42 years old. He has plenty of time still in his life to be able to have children. What makes them think that from now, when they go into Eretz Yisrael, he's not going to have any sons? So Marsha brings from the Aruch that another point. We said before that Moshe renamed him before he was named Hoshea. Now Moshe renamed him Yehoshua with a Yud. Now the Yud is a little tiny letter, so literally Resh Ktia, your head of your name is cut off in the sense that you have a little tiny letter at the beginning that was prepended to your name. But Marshall says that's also a little bit of a doichuk. What kind of thing is that? It's not like none of the other meraglim had names beginning with Yud either. So rather, Marashah says, it is something along those lines, but something else. We talked about before, Marashar explained that how were the Meraglim picked? Moshe's intention was that he would pick two Meraglim, and his intention was to pick Kalev and Pinchas, same way as Yeshua himself did 40 years later. But the Jewish people didn't want that. They each Shevet demanded their own Meragel, and they wanted to have their Nesiim pick them. So in the end, the Nasi of Shevet Ephraim picked Yeshua, and now Moshe has what to be worried about, that as we learned yesterday, that he might end up being caught up in the Lashon Hara of the other Meraglim, and therefore he had to add the Yud to his name. So they're making fun of him. Yud was added to your name. Big deal. You're no different than any of us. You were just appointed by the Nasi of the Shevet. There's no reason you should be any different than us and that you should be speaking. There's a few other explanations of this expression Resh Ktia. There is another point as well that it does have to do with the Yud, but let's consider, where did the Yud come from? Famously, we know that the Yud came from the name of Sarai, where the Yud was removed and it was replaced with a hay, and then the Yud was given to Yeshua. By the way, there's a cute word they say on that. You know, Yeshua is always called Yeshua Bin Nun. Why not Ben Nun? So there's a couple of different explanations. One of them, I think the Eben Ezra says, Pashut Bin Nun is easier to say than Ben Nun. But there is a cute explanation, and I think from the Vilna Gaon, I don't remember, who says when you consider it, the Yud was taken from Sarai's name. At the end of the word, it doesn't have a Nakuda. But now it's placed at the beginning of Yeshua's name. It has to have a Nakuda. It has to have a Shva. Where are those two dots going to come from? From the Segel, or Ben. So the Segel turns into a Chirik. Anyway, so the idea would be now the idea is, Api Kabbalah, the Yud, we know in general, Yud represents the masculine and Hey represents the feminine. The point that Sarai couldn't have children, as long as she's named that, is she has a Zohar aspect to her, and men don't carry pregnancies, they don't have children. Therefore, Hashem had to change it to a hey, a feminine letter. So now they're telling him, hey, look at that, Yeshua. Yeah, you have a Yud, but your name. But you know where that Yud comes from? It comes from Sarai, a woman. So what do you think, that you have the right to speak up among all of us men? And then Ben Yehoyada mentions a point as well. Here's another point. We know that 30 years before Yetzias Mitzrayim, Bnei Ephraim tried to leave Mitzrayim, and a bunch of them were killed by the Plishtim. So now they're telling Yeshua, you seem to be following in the same way. You don't care that already the head, a major part of your Shevet was cut off and killed, and you seem to be just doing the same thing. Let's recklessly go ahead, and let's not worry about the giants and whatnot. So therefore they're telling them, don't speak. Anyway, so Kolev sees that they're shouting down Yeshua. So Kolev thinks to himself, well, if I try to speak up in favor of going into Eretz Yisrael, they're also going to say something against me and tell me to be quiet. What might they say against him? Ben Yehoyada suggests that they might say, when you were in Hebron all by yourself, maybe the giants bribed you to say that we should all go in so they can all kill us. Another point is as well, Kolev was, we talked about before, Kolev was Moshe's brother-in-law, so for that reason alone, they'd have reason to say that he might be biased. Anyway, so Kolev thinks to himself, Eshtekinu Bereisha, let me first get them to be quiet, V'hodra Minalahu, and then I'll be able to tell them. So, Omer Lahem, so he tells them, he calls out to them, V'chizu Bilvad Osalon Ben Amram, is this the only thing that Ben Amram did to us? Now, first of all, the way he's saying V'chizu Bilvad makes it sound like he's going to say something bad, like here, he's already doing something bad to us by trying to get us to go into a dangerous land of Eretz Yisrael, and you think that's the only bad thing he did, so it sounds like he's going to say more accusations against Moshe. Second of all, calling him Ben Amram is usually the kind of thing people do when they want to speak disrespectfully, otherwise he'd call him by his name. Anyway, Savri, sure enough, they thought Bignusei Kamishtai is going to say something derogatory about Moshe. Ishtiku, so they all quieted down to hear what he has to say. Of Amalahan, now Kolev has his chance. He says to them, V'aloi hotzionim Mitzrayim, didn't he take us out of Mitzrayim? V'kodol lonu asayom, he split the sea for us. V'hodol lonu asamon, he brought down the mon. Im Yomas, so he's always done good things for us. Im Yomas, sus sulomis, v'alulu rakia. If Moshe were to tell us, make ladders and go up to the heavens, shouldn't we listen to him? So therefore, in other words, even if, the cities are gdolos of tzuras v'shamayim, nevertheless, if that's what it takes to go up there with ladders, that's what we're going to do. So Marashar point, why do you mention after these three things? Marashar explains like this. We learned yesterday about the names of the Meraglim. We talked about Sesur ben Michoel, that we have the Drosha Sesur, Shesoser Maisev Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which we said Marashar explained that it meant that he pretended as though the deeds of Hashem, as though the Nisim of Hashem had not happened. So now, Kolev says, on the contrary, he did. He took us out of Mitzrayim and split the Yamsu for us. Those are tremendous Nisim. And He said, Ben Michoel was Sha'osa Atme Moch, that he acted as though Hashem doesn't have the resources for them. So Kolev says, what are you talking about? You see that Hashem, that Moshe provided us from Hashem the resources that we need to eat the man. So therefore he's mentioning that. Then we had also about the Durosha of Nachbi ben Vofsi, that Vofsi was such a piece of Midosav, and he stepped over the Midas of Hashem and pretended as though Hashem doesn't reward and punish. So on the contrary, Kolev says, we're going to step. We're Oloi Nala. We'll even step up on ladders if we need to, if that's what it takes to get into Eretz Yisrael. Rashi on the Pasuk brings it a little bit differently. Instead of taking us out of Mitzrayim, Rashi has that he brought us the Slav. There's a Sicha where the Rebbe talks about why, according to that version, why Kolev picked these three things, and he explains the Meraglim were basically making three points. Number one, they were powerful Goyim, which we're going to have to fight them, and we don't have the ability to. Number two, there are Goyim even before we get to the borders of Eretz Yisrael. There are nations over there that won't even allow us in. And third of all, you have a Amalek is on the way, and you know we already tangled with a Amalek as a result of a lack of Emunah, and now also we don't really have the proper Emunah to be able to overcome them. So Kolev answers them with these three things. He says that Moshe, on behalf of Hashem, that split for us the Yamsuf, which means, in other words, when there was fighting needed to be done, then Hashem fought on our behalf, so don't worry about the powerful Goyim. Hashem provided us food in the Midbar, which shows that Hashem has the ability to give us food and therefore to make us be able to get into Eretz Yisrael and get the resources of it in the first place. And as far as Amalek, that we had our Suffolk, you know, with the Slav also, there was a complaint, and it was an unjustified complaint, because what are they saying they need meat for? Meat's not a necessity, and they had plenty of animals, and nevertheless, Hashem gave it to us through Moshe, so don't worry about the fact that you think we may not have enough Amuna, we'll overcome Amalek as well. So that's why you picked the point to Rashi, so that's the, in the Sifra, that's what I point to, that's what that would be why Kolev picked those three things.
Why Slav?
What? That's why Slav, because Slav is Slav.
Was the end of Slav not a good outcome?
It was, but there were two times they got Slav, actually, one in Parshas B'Shalach and the other one in Bahaloisa. The one in B'Shalach wasn't so bad. It's just Hashem says, I'm going to give it to you in the evening because you're not really asking for it properly because you don't really need it in the first place, and therefore I'm going to give it to you at a time when it's a tircha to prepare. Yeah, the one in Bahaloisa didn't end up so well, but nevertheless, he still brought it for us. That's the point. In other words, that makes the point in that sicha that Kolev is saying that, you know what, as much as we were complaining and quarrelsome and everything, as we have in this week's parasha, nevertheless, Hashem provided for us, so don't you worry, even if you think we don't have the emunah to overcome Amalek, Hashem will help us anyway. The Rebbe, by the way, also makes a point in that Sicha. You see, from this Gemara over here, you see that Yoshua, who's coming with the Koyach of Moshe, didn't have the ability to get the people to listen to him. He starts speaking and everybody shouts him down. Kolev, who was working from his Sarusa de Vosata, he went and davened by the Kivrei Ovis for Hashem to help him, so he has, more than Yoshua, the ability to get the people to be quiet and to say and to make this point.
When did he kill somebody. Chor,
that was earlier. That was by the Eagle. That was by the Eagle, yeah. What?
That was Caleb's son?
That was Chor's Caleb's son, yeah.
They tried to stop them
from making the Eagle, and they killed him, yeah. I guess Kolev wasn't worried, I guess, yeah. So Kolev says, Olei nala v'yarashnu oisa, we will surely go up, and that double expression will surely goes up, meaning even up to heaven, even with ladders, like you just said, v'yarashnu oisa, and we will possess it, and we'll take it over, ki yochol nuchala, because we can indeed do it. But v'hanoshim asher olu imay omru, but the other men, the other meraglim, would come up with him, omru, they said, loy nucha lalos el'am, we cannot go up against this people, ki chozak hu mimenu, because they're more powerful than mimenu. Now, the simple meaning of mimenu means than us. But the meraglim said a tremendous thing, a tremendous statement of kfira at that time. They said, when they said kichozeku mimenu, al tiku mimenu ela mimenu. Don't read mimenu, but rather mimenu. Now, Rashi says take out those words. Mimenu and mimenu is the same word. So it doesn't mean that we're saying, it's not an al-tikri, as we change the word. We're just darshaning the word mimenu differently. In Lashon Kodesh, the word mimenu means than us, or from us, whatever, and it can also mean than or from him. So therefore, so Chanan Bar Papa is taking it, Kav Yochol, after the Balabais, and Yochol, Lahotzi Kelev Misham, Kav Yochol, even the Balabais, Hashem, who is specifically, Hashem is the Balabais of the whole world, but Hashem's name is much more associated with Eretz Yisrael, He's called a lekei haaretz. He cannot even get his kelim out of there. In other words, so to speak, if Hashem deposited kelim over there, he wouldn't be able to get them out in the face of the goyim who are there. So they're saying a tremendous statement of kfirah. Now, so first of all, again, Rashi takes out this al-tikri. On the other hand, this piece of Gemara about Nimenu is also an erchin, because the Gemara talks about over there about the various times, the Mishnah and the Gemara talk about over there about the various times the Jewish people tested Hashem in the Midbar, and this is one of them. Tosfos mentions that point, mentions this point about al-tikri Nimenu, and Tosfos says it's very possible that actually there are two different ways of pronouncing Nimenu. And in fact, it is brought in Sifrei Dikduk that it seems this was one of the things. Now, for the most part, when in matters of Masorah, we usually follow what are called the Maravoi, the Chacham of Eretz Yisrael. But there was also Madin Choy, there were the Chacham of Bavel, and various places their Masorah was slightly different. There's many of the Sforim that mention this. Minchas Shai and Tanakh mentions this here and there, other collections of details about the Masorah mention. So it seems that the Madin Choy, and the Gemara, after all, the Gemara Bavli is written in Bavel, they had a Masorah that Mimenu, meaning then us, is with a Nun Rotha. So it would be Mimenu. But Mimenu, meaning from him, would be with a Nun Dogish, Mimenu. So in that case, it really would be an Al-Tikri, because the Gemara is saying, instead of reading it in the Pasuk, you would read it with a Nun Rafa, to mean then us. But really, you should also doubtion it as though it was with a Dogish, meaning then him. No, not Mila'el and Mila'ra. They would both be Mila'el, Mimenu, or Mimenu, maybe, but the point is mainly whether it's Dogish or Rafa, but yeah. So how could they say such a thing? So the Rebbe talks about an asicha, in keeping with the whole explanation of Pichsidus of what their mistake was, that basically they're saying when Hashem runs the world by Teva, then Hashem acts, so to speak, as though he can't override Teva, and therefore if we're expected to go into Eretz Yisrael and live a Teva-dicka life, then Hashem won't be able to protect us from falling into mistakes over there, and therefore, so to speak, he can't take his kelim out of there. But still, so it's wrong of them to say that, because Hashem is telling them to go into Eretz Yisrael and conquer and settle it and start farming it and whatever. Then it means Hashem is giving them the koichos to do that, and they shouldn't be denying that. There a couple of other interesting explanations of this Mimenu. The Maharal says the vort is the tichazikum Mimenu, taken in the simple sense, they're mightier than us, would mean, in other words, they're saying, yes, we're a mighty people, but the Knanim are mightier than us. But the fact is, they're saying further on, we were like grasshoppers in their eyes, so in that, and we felt like that ourselves. So in that case, they don't feel themselves to be strong. That is another reason to drive the Drosha, that they don't mean that the Knanim are stronger than us, but rather that they're stronger than Hashem. Bala Turim on the Pasuk mentions a couple of other interesting ideas. First of all, he says the word Mimenu can be related to the word Mona, which means a Keli in Aramaic. So Kichazaku Mimenu, like they're saying about the Kalim over here, that the Knanim are so strong, that Mimenu, that the Kalim could not be removed from there. Also, he says another point about the Al-Tikri Mimenu, other Mimenu, Bala Turim says, each of the letters of Mimenu, if you spell it out in full, is double. Mem is spelled out Mem, Mem. Nun is spelt Nun, Vav, okay, and another Nun. And Vav is Vav, and then either an Aleph or a Yud, or nothing in the middle, and a Vav. So therefore, like, each letter of Mimenu has, so like the word Mimenu in and of itself has a double meaning in it. So therefore, it can mean then us, and it can also mean then Hashem, and that's what the Meraglim, are saying.
You sure there's not another one?
I mean, there probably are other explanations as well, but those are a lot of explanations. Yom Mashiach of Ola, Yud-Gimel 7. So we know that the Beis Sinagodol, the head Sanhedrin of 71, that's going to be L'Osid Lavoi, is going to be greater than all the Batei Dinim of previous generations, V'chochmo V'minyan. Now we know the Mishnah tells us in Adius that for a Beis Din to override a Takana from an earlier Beis Din, they have to be greater V'chochmo V'minyan. Chachma means a knowledge of Torah. Minyan, there's a few different explanations what it means. It means age. It means the number of Chachma who agree with them, etc. Anyway, the point is, the Rebbe says, you know, listen, L'Asid Lavoi, all the Jewish people will be Chachma and G'dolim, and obviously the ones who are chosen for the Sanhedrin will be the cream of the cream. So therefore, so they'll be greater than all the previous generations. And certainly the Rosh Hashiva, the Abbasin, the Nasi, who's taking the place of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is Melech HaMashiach, is going to be much greater in Chochmah than all the Oves Batyagin in the generations before, even greater than Moshe Rabbeinu, since after all, as we know, Mashiach is going to teach Torah to the Tanoim and Amiroim and even to Moshe Rabbeinu. The result of that being, in other words, that Sanhedrin will have the ability to override certain Zedas and Takonis and things from previous Batyagin, where you need B'chochmah, where you need greater B'chochmah of in order to be able to do that. Okay, continuing with halachas of Yom Tov. So we talked about yesterday you're not allowed to put out a fire on Yom Tov, or even to indirectly cause it to put out. You are allowed to. On the other hand, for example, you have a burner on a stove, you can cover it with a blech or something. It might go out a little bit, but you're not mechaven for it, and some malachas and tzurich legufa, so that kind of thing would be allowed for tzurich Yom Tov, but only for that day, not for that night, because the night already belongs to the next day. Practically speaking, with our stoves nowadays, you can't turn down the gas because that would be kibbutz. And if it's an electric stove, same thing. You also can't turn down. You can't turn down the dial. Same thing.
To put on a Shabbos clock.
Would you be allowed to put it on a Shabbos clock when before Shabbos?
Or Yom Tov.
Yeah, before Yom Tov.
On Shabbos itself, you can't. Something like that. But
well, you can't put anything on a Shabbos clock on Shabbos itself. But yeah. There are certain kinds of things you can't put. There are certain kinds of things you can't put on a Shabbos clock because Avshem Milsa, like it makes a loud noise and it disturbs the spirit of Shabbos and Yom Tov. People have talked about, for example, let's say you wanted to put on a radio or a TV or something on a Shabbos timer. That kind of thing doesn't work. But nowadays anyway, a lot of the ovens have Shabbos mode, so you put it on that and then that's it. You don't touch it. But yeah, okay. Suppose you have a keli that got treifed up. So you can't do hagolah or libun of it on Yom Tov. Strictly speaking, Alter Rebbe says if you couldn't do it erev Yom Tov, then it would be mutter. But it's halacha vein morin kain. The Alter Rebbe actually adds if it only requires kashering because chumra ba'alma, then you would be allowed to do that on Yom Tov. And similarly, also kelim that need only libun kal. You can't tovel kalim on Yom Tov either. The one thing you can do in principle is you can do hashaka with them. In principle, you have water inside the keli and you want to be matahar the water by touching it to the mikvah water. So then in principle, you can do that kind of thing on Yom Tov. Nowadays we don't have that. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch refers over here to what he discusses earlier in connection with the halachas of tevilas kelim. So what you would have to do if you didn't tovel a keli before Yom Tov, give it to a goy as a matana, and then borrow it from him, and then after Yom Tov, tovel it without a bracha. Another possibility is if it's something that can hold water, then you can go dip it in the mikveh and make like you're carrying water home in it, and then you've toveled it. So, but then you wouldn't make a bracha on that tevilah.